know, Dad and I were just saying how strange it is to think that the next time a comet comes by, we'll be long gone.
Yeah, so were we.
It makes you realize how precious our time here is.
Remember when Dad taught us the constellations?
The camping trip in Maine?
Yeah.
My favorite was Orion.
Really? Mine too. And Ben's. Aaron is just fascinated by Cassiopeia. Val, you are not okay.
What do you do if you are at opposite poles politically from somebody you love? How do you keep that from tearing you apart? That has become eerily timely since the most recent presidential election.
Yes, indeed.
Can you be a good American if you don't like what your government is doing?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Content King with me, your host, David Rolls. And in this episode, I will be talking to a very multi-talented lady who wears many hats, and in her current guise as playwright, Dr. Paula Kaplan, who has an award-winning show currently playing just off Broadway called Shades. And may I give a warm welcome to Dr. Paula Kaplan. So, please tell us all about Shades.
Well, it's a play that has four characters. Three are members of a family. They're all adults, and one is not a member of that family. And they, three of them are military veterans. One is the father, who's a World War II veteran, and his son, who's a Vietnam War veteran. They're American. And the father's daughter, who's slightly older than the son, and she was a protester against the Vietnam War. So you can tell she and her brother are at opposite poles politically, and they're very different in their personality styles, too. And this causes a lot of conflict between them and some humor as well.
Yes.
The father just wants everybody to get along. He's a really sweet guy, very expansive, very warm. He runs a restaurant. And the daughter, whose name is Val, she's in her mid-40s. She has recently lost her husband, who also was a Vietnam War veteran. And she's come to visit her father and her brother. And she is a nurse. And while she's there, she learns about a woman who was also in Vietnam as a clerk typist in the army, a black woman who was paralyzed from the neck down by an exploding grenade. And this woman is named June. She has a job and works very hard, but she needs a nurse to help her. And so Val and June develop a friendship in the course of the play. It's very interesting. You don't see a lot about good friendships between women on stage very often.
Oh, really?
You know, very often you have the stereotypic, women, they have cat fights, they're at each other's throats, they're always competing against each other for a man and that sort of thing. You don't often see the ups and downs of really good, interesting friendships between women. And in the play, from the beginning, Val she's torn apart internally by a secret. They all have secrets, every one of the characters.
Like all of us, I guess, in real life, no?
Well, yes. But, you know, when they're painful secrets, they often create distance between you and the people you care about because you keep the secret, whether you're keeping the secret to try to protect them or to try to protect yourself. And often it's very scary to think of speaking to someone about what you've been bearing on your own for a long time. And so one of the reasons that the play is called Shades is because as someone I knew, a wonderful theater person named Eden Harmon Bernardi said, she said, shades are what we lower to keep the darkness and the secrets in. But when we raise them, they let in the light. So that's part of what it's about. And it's also called Shades because It's addressing the question of what do you do if you are at opposite poles politically from somebody you love? How do you keep that from tearing you apart? That has become eerily timely since the most recent presidential election. And also it's about what makes somebody a good American, and can you be a good American if you don't like what your government is doing? Again, it's become eerily timely since this most recent election.
Yes, there's
also, as I said, there's a lot of love, there's a lot of humor in the show, there's some poetry as well. And it's about how when you can connect with somebody through respect, through love, through care, you are often strengthened to the point where you can speak about a secret that is more painful to keep in isolation than to talk about it. As one of the veterans in the play says, when he finally talks about one of his most painful memory from the Vietnam War, and another one of the veterans asks him, "How are you okay?" He says, "Actually, I am." He's just told this such a painful story that he's never told anyone before about what he saw in Vietnam. And when the woman veteran asks him, "Are you okay?" He says, "Actually, I am. My rucksack just got lighter."
Well, that's very sweet. Yes. I mean, obviously, in the light of recent events in this election year, I mean, how long had the story been developing before, obviously before the play came to production?
That's a great question. Actually, I first wrote the first version of this play in 2000, 2001. And the first time, it's changed a fair bit since then. There are two totally new scenes. There's a lot that's been revised. Actually, even since it won these two awards for best new play that it won. But it's kind of an interesting history, because the first time it ever had a public reading was in something like September 7th of 2001. This was in Providence, Rhode Island, in a new plays festival.
Wow.
And it was supposed to have a couple more readings. Yeah, I know you see where this is going.
It was supposed to have
a couple more readings over the next 10 days of the festival. Well, we did the first reading. And when I wrote this play, I thought I was writing a history play. It takes place in 1997, which is the year that the Hale-Bopp comet came through the skies. And that plays a role in the play as well, because it's about, you know, when something happens that will never again happen in your lifetime. It really makes you think about your mortality, and as the father in the play says, makes you realize how precious our time here is. And so I wrote the play, we did this reading, and there was going to be two more readings of it soon, and then 9/11 happened, and so the rest of the festival was canceled. And a week or two after that, I went back to the script to make some revisions based on what I had learned from the reading, and I got chills up my spine. I thought, oh my God,
I
thought I wrote a history play, but it's about what's happening now. And subsequently, Bob Colonna, who's a brilliant director and actor in Providence, Rhode Island, he directed readings of it around Rhode Island over the next few months. And we would always follow the readings with a discussion with the audience, whatever they wanted to talk about. Well, that was at a time when President George W. Bush was saying very, very clearly, if you don't like what my government is doing in response to 9/11, you're not a patriotic American. And
yeah.
So in these discussions that we would have after the readings, so many people said, you know, this is the first time since 9/11 that I've felt safe talking about how I really feel. And so then I put the play away for a while. I was raising my kids. I was a professor at the University of Toronto. I was writing nonfiction books. I was doing a lot of other things.
Yeah, indeed.
And then when I came back to the play and made a number of changes. And now here it is in New York. Do you know what day we did the first New York performance? It was the very day after the presidential election.
Wow.
So it was, again, people were saying, how did you know this going to happen? I can't claim that I knew.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, it's some foresight that you have that,
Right. Just, no, I mean, how I wish that this were not so relevant today.
But obviously, I mean, it's very important, though, that the play, you know, it does depict, you know, what is actually happening in reality. I mean, for so many of us, we, you know, maybe we have a hard day at work. I understand we come home and, yeah, you just want maybe television or something that's very light and, you know, doesn't really make you, you know, consider what's really happening around you. And obviously, you know, watching this play, obviously it brings home, well, some home truths, really, I guess, for many people.
Yeah, that it's been very moving, people's responses to the play, because people have been saying that, you know, if this had been a play about, all right, Trump is president now, and here's what he's doing, and here's how people are reacting, there's so much happening right now that gets in the way, that makes people upset, that makes them afraid, that makes them, or if they're supporters of Trump, that makes them very enthusiastic. But feelings are so high about exactly what's going on now. In a way, it gives people a kind of distance from exactly what's happening now in the details, in the specifics, and they can go and they can get immersed in the world of this play, Shades, that is happening in an earlier time. But they come to care about the characters. People have said they get really involved with the four people on that stage and their relationships and their feelings and the issues that they're grappling with, the personal ones, the political ones, and getting involved in that helps them clarify what they feel. You know, that's one of the great things that theater can do, is you see what other people are going through, and you feel in this visceral way, where are you on that stage, you know? And then that makes it easier, having gotten that distance from the immediate details and specifics, to come back to the present. And, you know, it's helping people clarify, I think, what they believe, what they feel, what they want to happen. And then it's sort of a comfort, you know, if you're at opposite poles politically from somebody you care about, sort of a comfort to see people working that sort of thing out on the stage. And you don't feel you're the only one who's dealing with this sort of thing right now. So we've been very lucky. We've had wonderful actors. Hal Robinson plays the father, and he's done a lot of Broadway and off-Broadway. He's going to be understudying Danny DeVito on Broadway starting in February in a production of Arthur Miller's The Price. And we have Ashley Wren Collins, who went to the ART Conservatory in Cambridge, Mass. At Harvard, who plays Val, who plays the anti-war protester and the nurse. And her younger brother is played by a marvelous actor named Carson Lee, who just embodies what many veterans are like. And then Holly Walker, who plays the woman who's the vet and who's in a wheelchair. She was on, if you saw Larry Wilmore's The Nightly Show, which ended recently, but it was wonderful social commentary, and she used to do a regular spot on there called Lady Time. Okay. It was very satirical. So we have a great cast, and Alex Keegan is the director, and she's just been great.
Oh, that's excellent. I mean, how would you say, I mean, the parallels between obviously what was happening in Vietnam, like the political divisions at that time. I mean, do you see them being relevant to what's happening now here in the US with, you know, such disparities between these sort of political ideologies?
Oh, absolutely. One of the themes that comes out in the show is the question of what are people's attitudes toward the government and toward the military? So you see in the play, some people saying our government is honest, our government and our military would never lie to us. And so whatever they say must be right. And of course, the father, who's the World War II veteran, says, you felt so justified protecting the world against that monster. And then, of course, the experience in Vietnam was very different. And the brother, who spends part of the play very much standing up for what he did in Vietnam and why the United States was there and that sort of thing. And he has real integrity. You know, one of the things that people are saying is whatever audience members feel about the Vietnam War, they really care about this man who, even though his views about the war differ greatly from theirs, he clearly believes in them. You know, he's sincere. He's not just, he's not somebody who loves violence. He says, I didn't go to Vietnam to be a killer. And yet, it turns out in the course of the play, he's becoming quite ill. And the illness is mysterious. And his sister, the nurse, starts to suspect what it is that's going on. And sure enough, it turns out he was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and he was one of the people who sprayed Agent Orange. And he says, oh, what's happening to me, this infection in my lungs. Yet he thinks his sister is nuts to say, I think it was the effects of Agent Orange exposure. He says, that's ridiculous. You know, when we were given this stuff to spray and we saw that it took the leaves off the trees and we said, what is this? He says, they explained to us, it's nothing. It just takes the leaves off the trees so you can see the enemy. Right? And he genuinely believes this. So that's why it's important that the play takes place in 1997, because the military and the VA were very much denying that Agent Orange had caused any harm at that point. So, you know, right now, people on both sides, at both ends of the political spectrum, are saying, whom in the government and whom in the military should we believe? And should we believe everything we're told? And, you know, since if you came of age in the 60s, as I did, it's really hard not to question, but it's really hard not to have faith in your leaders. And so a lot of people are, just like during the Vietnam War, are today trying to find that balance. And I tell you something, between the time I wrote the first version of the play and when I did a lot of revisions more recently, one of the things that happened was I became very involved with veterans. I hadn't been very involved when I first wrote the play, but I knew some things from a few that I'd been very close to. And I wrote, my most recent nonfiction book is called When Johnny and Jane Come Marching Home, How All of Us Can Help Veterans. Because when the wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and then Iraq started, I just started listening to what people coming back from those wars would say. You know, I'm a psychologist, and as a researcher and as a person, I know that if there's some area you don't know anything about, it's best to start by just listening to whatever the people who know have to tell you, what they want to say, instead of coming in with your questions as though, yes, Here's what matters, you know. So I created a listening project. It's called Welcome Johnny and Jane Home. The website is listen and then the numeral 2, listentoveterans.org. And we just pair a non-veteran, who ideally isn't a therapist, just a person from your community, with a veteran from any era, combat or not, woman or man. Okay. And the job of the non-veteran is just to listen to whatever the veteran wants to tell them.
How long have you been doing this?
Oh, for about four and a half years. And
Wow. Quite a while.
Yeah, there are listeners all over the country. Some places have sort of a chapter of, you know, their own local version of this that's affiliated with us centrally. And sometimes people will just read the book, and it says in there all you need to know. You can learn it in 1 minute. In fact, I want to tell you what it is, because you... people say, how much training do you need? And I say about 37 seconds because here, I'm going to tell you, David, here's all you need to know to go out and listen to a veteran. You say one sentence to start with, and this sentence, every bit of it, was chosen based on my dozen years of listening to veterans. And it goes like this. You say, now you couldn't say the first part. You'd have to say as a person living in this country, but you can say as an American or as a person living here, I take some responsibility for what you experienced in the military and trying to come home. And if you want to talk, I will listen for as long as you wish to speak and I will not judge. And then you just listen.
Okay.
But you listen with your whole heart. And veterans who do this, who do the speaking, will tell us, they often use the term magical. They say, when another human being, and it's not your family or your best friend, so you don't have to be worried about how they're going to react, you know. And you know the other person is just going to listen. They're not going to do that awful thing that people often do with vets, which is you hear they're a vet and the first thing you say is, did you kill anybody?
Yes, I say yeah.
It's just shattering how often that happens. And they know you're not going to say, well, your buddy got blown up by an IED, but you shouldn't feel guilty. It wasn't your fault. Well, that's not what you say to somebody who's been through that. So when the vets say, when they know that somebody's just going to listen, and then in about the first 3 to 5 minutes, because they see that person really is listening with 100% of their attention, that creates such a safe place.
We will be right back.
I'm Paul George of the Indiana Pacers. When I was 6, my days were spent playing basketball. When I was 6, my dream was to make it to the NBA. When I was 6, my mom had a stroke. So I want you to learn to spot a stroke fast. F-A-S-T. F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. I'm Paul George. Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can. Should have worn my glasses. So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
We return to Dr. Paula Kaplan.
There was a bit of a racial overtone to the play as well. In what respect? Yes.
Well, race comes in to the play in a lot of different ways. For one thing, Val, the nurse, is white and Jewish. So are her father and her brother, of course. And her father in World War II, and this is based on my father's actual experience, was captain of an all-black artillery battery. And he tells the story about how when World War II started, the U.S. military had segregated the forces and would not let blacks go into battle because the myth was that they were cowards. They'd run away.
And,
really? Yes. And many of the men in this unit who fought at the Battle of the Bulge in Bastogne, which was really a crucial battle of World War II.
Yeah, indeed. It was.
Right. They were surrounded by the Nazis. And it looked like they were done for. But what happened was that these men, they were mostly from the Deep South, had very little education, but they worked so hard and learned how to operate the artillery equipment, surveying equipment, use logarithmic tables. And they scored so well on their tests that the Army had to let them go into battle. And they won a presidential citation for meritorious service. So it comes out that way. It comes out when June, the black woman in the wheelchair, talks about how her brother had enlisted to go to Vietnam. And he was treated in the most racist ways by the white guys, some of the white guys in his unit. And she was a clerk typist, but the colonel that she worked for, who was white, would sexually harass her and say it was both sexism and racism. He'd say, "Oh, wow. Strong black women are sexy," and he knew she was married. And the other way it comes out is that, two other ways. One is that Val was very politically active, but she hadn't been the target of racism. And so she describes having come to discover certain things about her government, about the military, that were quite shocking to her. She realized that she wasn't safe when she went to demonstrate on an army base. She was arrested, and she thought, well, where's the freedom of speech here? And June, the black woman, is listening to this and saying, so you were in your 20s and you never knew about that stuff? She said, nobody in my school could not know about that. And so the women explore the differences in their experiences based on race, and some of the similarities based on the fact that they're both women and they both grew up as females. And the other way that that race comes into it is that you learn that Val's husband, who has recently died, was Japanese American, and he was born in one of the internment camps that the government put Japanese Americans into in California when World War II broke out, treating them as, you know, dangerous aliens. And he enlisted to go to Vietnam to prove he was a real American. And then he was subjected to racism by the guys in his platoon because he was Asian, you know, and the enemy was Asian, and they said awful things to him. And so it comes in many ways.
Wow. Well, yeah, I mean, it's really very intricate and deep, you know, in many places.
And also sexism comes in a number of ways, partly because Val is, most of her life, she's been sort of like the traditionally socialized woman. She's been outgoing and warm and expressive and thinks everybody should talk about their feelings, and actually to the point where she can get a little irritating within that. And she's saying to her father, Dad, how was Mom when you were overseas during World War II? And he said, oh, she was fine. She says, well, maybe she didn't tell you that she was upset, that she was angry you were away. And he says, or maybe she wasn't angry, says the father and the brother. And the brother is more like a traditionally socialized male. He doesn't talk about his feelings. He doesn't want her to try to get him to talk about his feelings. He thinks there's something wrong with her. Yeah. So, and some of it's funny and some of it is sort of sad. At one point, June says she is suspecting that what's happening to Don's health is because of Agent Orange, and she says, have you talked to Don's doctor about this? And she says, no, he won't let me talk to his doctor. And June's surprised. She says, but you're a nurse, you know, you have medical knowledge. And Val says, well, you know, all our lives, he hasn't wanted to get close to me. She says, when I was 14, I read in a novel that brothers and sisters could be each other's confidants. She said, I'd never thought of that, because he'd been so reserved, never entered her mind. So she read this in the book, and she got all excited. She says, so I ran into Don's room, and I said, Don, I'll tell you if Ray has kissed me, if you'll tell me if you have a crush on Susie. And June says, and what did he say? And she says, he said, but I don't care if Ray has kissed you. Right? And that's, you know, that's such a typical thing, right? So there are a lot of moments of humor in the
And during the play, do we discover, I mean, obviously there's no mention of the mother so far. Do we find out what happened there, or is that some sort of subplot during the play, or some sort of bone of contention at any point?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. When I first wrote the play, she had died, but But somebody would play her in the play. Nobody saw, nobody else on stage would see her, but she was there sort of as a ghost. And, you know, in Shakespeare's time, the word shades meant a ghost, which is another reason the play is called Shades. Yeah. And the mother is talked about a lot in the play. Her presence is very powerful because she was, the daughter says, my mother loved this one line from a poem called To a Sad Daughter by Michael Ondaatje, and the line goes like this: want everything. If you break going out, not in.
Wow.
And that was what the mother was like. She was very outgoing and she was very loving. And Val has tried to be like her, but it hasn't worked for her. There, we find out there were problems in Val's relationship with her late husband, and the mother had been very pained, just like her daughter, when Don signed up to go to Vietnam. But the brother could somehow deal with that because it was his mother.
Yes.
And at one point, at this pivotal point in the play, he says, the son says to his sister, he says, yeah, you hated me for going. And she is stunned. She says, that wasn't hate. That was fear. And he says, I never knew that. Now, just think how much that kind of misunderstanding, that because we have different political views, you hate me, instead of you're terrified I'll die over there, you know? And that's one example of why it can be. Sometimes silence is a good thing, but sometimes you need to talk because you're making assumptions that can destroy your relationship.
Yeah, and indeed.
So the mother is very prominent, and there are stories about her. At one point, the father tells what was her favorite joke that she had made into a feminist joke, and the audience always loves this joke. She is one of the shades in the sense of ghost, and then so is Val's late husband, because little by little in the course of the play, you find out more about him and how he was haunted by his time in Vietnam as well, and how he dealt with it.
And in terms of the inspiration for the play, I mean, how did it come about?
Oh, another great question. Well, I was interested in my father's experience as having been in World War II and having been captain of an all-black battery, and how fond he was of the men that he served with. And one of the men he served with, who was a sergeant, was the closest friend he ever had in the world.
Wow.
And he just had such fondness for all of the men. And in fact, since he died about 7 years ago, I met someone who was also a sergeant, who was his first sergeant, a man who had been born very poor, black, the 12th child of 12, of very poor tobacco farmers. And actually, this Sunday, I'm flying to North Carolina. He's still alive. He lives in Kinston. His name is Isaac Pope, and he is turning 99 this weekend.
Wow. Congratulations to him.
Thank you. I'll tell him. And we are making a documentary that centers around him. It's called Isaac Pope, The Spirit of an American Century, because he went from never having left Kinston and then going overseas and, you know, becoming part of World War II and this crucial battle and the presidential citation. And then he came back home to confront the racism back in his hometown. He threw away his medals. He was devastated. But he worked with the NAACP. He was a janitor at DuPont because he was poor and he was black, and that's what you could do there.
Of course.
But when the union wanted to come into DuPont, he bravely said straight out that he was for the union. It's amazing he survived in that kind of circumstance. When Kinston had its first Big Brother, Big Sister organization, he was the first volunteer. He's an amazing man, and he's still very smart and warm and a real man of faith, and loves music and sings and plays. And
wow.
So we're working on a film about him. We're looking for funding, actually, so we can get this made.
Well, I'm sure he's got so many interesting stories and
he does.
Anecdotes to tell.
But anyway, back to your question about how the play was born. So partly it was my interest in my father. Partly the brother in the play is based not on my brother, but on someone my family knew very well, who we were very close to, who was a Marine helicopter pilot and who was, like the character in the play, he was running triathlons and suddenly he was getting lung infections. But the rest of his body was in perfect condition. He was winning triathlons. And then it was Agent Orange that led to his death because, of the deterioration of his lungs. And so, and I was interested, and I was an anti-war protester during Vietnam. I've always been interested in the dynamics between the sexes and how we, what I always say to my students is, in our culture, even today to a great extent, and here's what we do. We say, if you are male, then you are supposed to act and feel in the following ways. And if you are female, you are supposed to act and feel very, very differently. And then when you grow up, one member of each group pair up with a member of the other group and live happily ever after. Go ahead. What a crazy way to operate. So that's part of what's in the play. And then I once heard about some people. I was living in Toronto who were part of a women's group, a feminist group, and they were on a volunteer basis. They were helping a woman who was paralyzed from the neck down. And I don't want to give away a crucial part of the play, but something that they said to me just made me start thinking about, well, what wars affect people differently, depending partly on whether your war was a so-called good war or a bad war, depending partly on your race, depending partly on your sex, depending partly on your personality. And so that's part of what the play is about, is that decades later, this is a quarter of a century after Vietnam that the play takes place, and it's decades after World War II, and you see the war experiences and how they continue to affect people even all this time later, and how they affect, through Val, we see how they affect people who weren't even in a war. And I think that at our peril, do we try to ignore as a nation the fact that it's not that you go away to war and you come back and then it's all behind you.
Exactly.
It pervades the whole country.
We will be right back.
Dear John, I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is serious, and I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to when you checked on me? I don't want to leave, but remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get yours to a healthy range today. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Hey everyone, let's all stop what we're doing and take a moment. You see? Every moment can be kind of special. But they can be loud moments, goofy moments, dorky moments, it doesn't matter. Because every time dads like us take a moment like that to spend with our kids, well, it's pretty momentous. So let's take a moment to make a moment. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
We return to Dr. Paula Kaplan.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I mean, as an outsider, I guess, I mean, quite new here to the US, I mean, you know, I've been to many sort of ball games, and obviously you see, you know, the allegiance to the flag of the schools, and, the affection and the respect for the, for the military. But at the same time, yes, maybe I see that sort of pervades into a sort of, a sense that if you if you don't support the military and everything that they, or the government and everything that they do, then you're seen as being non-patriotic, which, like you say, is not always the case.
Right. And you know, I lived in Canada for 19 years. I'm Canadian and American. And one of the things I loved about Canada and that I love about Great Britain is this notion of the loyal opposition, which we don't have here. Yeah. You know, the idea in these other countries that the opposition is loyal, shows its loyalty by poking holes in whatever the government suggests. You know, you're supposed to point out the flaws. You're supposed to suggest other alternatives, you know, other kinds of action. And in the United States, too often, if you go against what the government wants, then you're accused of being un-American, unpatriotic. And
yes.
I think that's dangerous. It really, it stifles dissent, it stifles creativity, and it narrows the kinds of paths that we can take to solve the kinds of problems that most of us want to solve. You know, we want to have jobs, we want to have peace, we want to have good education and the arts and so on.
I would totally agree with that.
In the United States, 93% of Americans living today have not served in the military, and 99% have never been in a war. And because of the chasms that so often exist between veterans and non-veterans, the vast majority, almost all Americans, haven't a clue what it's like to be in the military and certainly not what it's like to be in a war. And when you have a tiny percent of the population having gone through the hell of being at war, or even just, if they weren't deployed, the totally different culture of being in the military, and the rest of us don't know that, don't even, whatever our politics, if we don't really know the specifics of what that was like,
exactly,
then what it means is that people who serve in our name, whether they're being sent to serve in ways that we agree with or not, but they're serving in our names, they come back and they live in our communities, and we have no idea what their lives are like. And when they suffer, whether it's because of being at war, whether it's because of having been raped in the military, which vast yeah. percentages of women have, and a smaller percentage of men.
That's very true.
Right? Or whether it was just the culture shock of going from civilian life to the military and then back again through another culture shock back into civilian life. I mean, that is tremendous, two tremendous upheavals in your life. And what I say is that the vast majority of Americans are what I call war illiterate and even military illiterate. And
yes.
that's not healthy for the vets, and it's not healthy for the rest of society.
Indeed,
it means
yeah.
that there are all these secrets, you know, and we need to know about them. And that's why we do the listening sessions. And that's part of what happens in the play, too.
No, I mean, I totally agree on that point. I mean, it's fascinating for TV and playwrights and radio, for example, but certainly
yes.
in the actual real world, unfortunately, does exist.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I hope that people who hear this will race over to the Cherry Lane Theater Studio in New York in Greenwich Village. It's a great place. And see the Shades. It closes this Saturday night. So there's just, almost no chances left to see it.
Okay.
And
well, if there are tickets available.
Yes, there are some available. Yeah.
Then, I mean, obviously, I guess people can find tickets at what, www.cherrylanetheatre.org?
That's right. Or you can go to our Facebook page, which is called Shades the Play, and click where it says Book Now, and that will take you right there.
Well, that's great, Dr. Kaplan. So And do you have any plans to take the show anywhere else?
Well, these things cost money, and we did this on a donation from an anonymous donor who had seen the play in L.A. and loved it and thought it really mattered and was moved by it. And so if there are any donors out there, I'd love to do it again somewhere else. We're going to do some excerpts from it in New London, Connecticut, in an art gallery where there's going to be a month of events for veterans and about veterans. And we also have a film called Is Anybody Listening? That is about the same theme, some of the same themes, and about bridging the chasms between veterans and non-veterans in this country. So people can email me through the website about any of this, about the play, about the film, or about the work with veterans, if they just go to listen2veterans.org, and there's a contact form, and you can email me through there, and I'd love to hear from you.
That's great, Dr. Kaplan. Well, I hope to our listeners out there that that's been a rewarding interview, and that hopefully if you still haven't got tickets to see the show, that you can still have the opportunity to do so, or if not, like I say, check out your website for any future productions and
that's right,
that are in the offing. So
yes, and I'll be there for the last two performances on the 16th and 17th of December.
Oh, great,
I'd love to meet any of your listeners. And thank you. You're a wonderful interviewer.
Well,
that's
very
so
kind
much.
Of you to say so, Dr. Kaplan.
Excellent.
It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. And I wish you all the best, well, for this show and for any future productions and works that you have in the offing. So
thank you. Thank you
okay,
so
and
much.
I look forward to talking with you again sometime in the future.
I'd love that. Okay, thanks.
That's
bye-bye.
Great. Okay, well, happy holidays to you as well.
Thank you.
That's
you
great.
Too.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, I'd like to give a big warm thank you there to Dr. Paula Kaplan for giving us an overview of her current play, Shades, that is currently playing at the studio at Cherry Lane Theatre, located at 38 Commerce Street in New York City. Tickets are still available, and those in military service and veterans are eligible for half-price tickets, so don't miss out. For further news and information and updates about Dr. Paula Kaplan's work and events, please check out her website at paulajkaplan.net. That's Kaplan with a C. And find us on Twitter at Content King Show, and myself at Rock and Rolls DJ. Visit our production company at zimmer.co. That's the word remix, backwards, or mixer, shuffled. Many thanks, and we look forward to you joining us next time on Content King.